You are listening to Iconocast, a science and science advocacy podcast. I am Mike Harvick, and my co-host is Greg Layden. This is a show about something, and that something is science. The podcast has its roots in Atheist Talk, a radio production of the Minnesota Atheist. Greg and I teamed up for many episodes that brought forth topical issues in science, including the teaching of evolution, the science standards in Minnesota, climate change, food security, astrophysics, and more. I moved away from Minnesota, and I could no longer host the Atheist Talk show, but Greg and I decided that we could do some podcasting, and thus Iconocast was formed. I am Mike Harbeck, and I am not a scientist. I consider myself a science cheerleader. I was host and producer of Atheist Talk, which airs on AM 950 in Minneapolis and St. Paul for several years, and my most controversial and most fulfilling shows dealt with science.
I'm Greg Layden, and I am a scientist. I'm a biological anthropologist, but really mostly these days I'm a science writer and communicator. My own evolution, in a sense, is reflected in the work I've done with Mike and also Lynn Feldman at the Atheist Talk, where I started out being interviewed. I was a guy that you interviewed about this science topic or that science topic, usually evolution, creationism, science policy. Increasingly, I found myself on that radio show as part of more of a three-way conversation, you know, with you, somebody else, and me, and it wasn't really clear who the interviewer was. And that was kind of Lynn Feldman's influence, too, I think. And then eventually I became one of the interviewers. So this podcast seems to be the next logical step.
Now, I just want to establish what we mean when we use the word science, because there seem to be many definitions of what it is. What do we do with science? How do we use it? And what values does it have beyond answering questions on the nature of, nature?
Yeah, I think actually that's a really important question, because part of the problem we have in the general public understanding of science is exactly that. What is science? For one thing, people often relate science to a subset of the actual sciences, even to the point where somebody who is a scientist will be taken as an authority on a topic, even though they're not actually even closely related to that topic in their research.
Like Michio Kaku being interviewed, he's a physicist, he got interviewed about whether or not evolution was stopped.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And Neil deGrasse Tyson talking about GMOs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I want to know about magnetic plasmas when I talk to Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Right.
So it's great that these big talking heads are promoting science. And if they want to talk about any kind of science, that's fine. But as somebody who's, for example, studied the evolution of human food systems, I don't want to hear an argument from authority that a physicist has said a certain thing about them. And also in school, you know, we learn what science is in school because we learn like the scientific method and we get a certain view of how science works that way. And I think that is a bit misleading too, because there isn't a single scientific method that you can easily describe in a simple way that applies to how all of the different, many different kinds of sciences are done. I think that thinking about things scientifically as a practice can apply to everything in life pretty much. It's being aware of the fundamental flaws in the evidence that you're using. It's understanding that you have to have a kind of testable or at least evaluatable model for the parts of the world that you're looking at or working on. It doesn't matter too much what you're doing. Obviously, a creative process may not be that scientific, but even there, you're going to find scientific aspects, I think.
And part of it, too, I know that Richard Feynman famously said, you know, science is about not fooling yourself, and the easiest person that you're to fool is yourself. And so there's a lot of structure in science to try to eliminate any kind of bias you might bring into testing your idea to see if it actually reflects the nature of causation and phenomena.
Part of that method even is not even just coming up with testable hypotheses and collecting data a certain way, but it really is rather what I like to call developing the art of the honest conversation, where you have people who are truly in it, truly engaged in the conversation to try to figure something out. And there isn't a hidden agenda. It's exactly the opposite, or not the opposite, but completely and utterly different than what happens, for example, in a court case. It is different than what happens in a debate. Mm-hmm. It's different than what happens in a political policy making process, where you're just trying to get, everybody is trying to bring to the table what they are good at and trying to find out what other people are good at so they can ask them things and trying to solve a problem and knowing that when they're done solving the problem, there's going to be a lot of work to do to take it to the next step. but it's all done in the way that if I hear you say something that I could complain about and yell at you about and make obnoxious tweets about, instead, mm-hmm. I ask you what you meant.
Sure.
And then move on from there. And when that honest conversation is about the things that are in nature, then you're doing science.
So I'm kind of wondering, too, why there is so much confusion about science. We argue all the time about what science says. One day, you know, they'll say that coffee is good for you, and the next they'll say that, you know, that it causes cancer. How can these things always be so wrong?
one of the ways in which science is often misunderstood is to think about it as a way of explaining how A causes B, which I think a lot of people, if I just said science is about how something in nature that is A causes the result B, and scientists are trying to figure that out, most people would say, yeah, that sounds right, and they would just think that that's what science is about. But really what science is about is understanding how variations in a state of A relate to variations in a state of B. Science is about variability and variation and complex interactions of things. So when some study shows a what might relate to a negative result because of caffeine consumption, and a different study shows what might relate to a positive result of caffeine consumption, they could both be right. Or there could be some truth underlying both studies that isn't actually reflected in the abstract of either study at this time, mm-hmm. because science is being advanced here. But those studies get translated into press releases. You know what? Nobody notices the good press releases. There actually are quite a few good ones, but no one notices them. But you really notice the bad ones.
Sure.
And press releases are often very, very bad. And they are then either cut and pasted wholesale by certain news outlets or badly mangled. And then the information in them, often just a headline, which was miswritten by an editor who'd never read the press release and put the headline on, is then tweeted. I mean, these days, or put on a Facebook post, and no one even reads, you know, a Facebook post has a headline and then little words underneath. Nobody even reads the words underneath. They
right.
just read the headline. Okay. So it isn't actually true that the coffee was good for you. It isn't actually true that the coffee was bad for you. The study never said that. The press release never even said it. But the headline kind of implied it, and then when it got on Facebook or Twitter, it became that fact.
Sure.
So the first problem with the idea of science, especially medical science and nutrition-related stuff, always coming up with opposite results back and forth and back and forth, is that it actually doesn't do that often.
In scientific studies, too, also, the more illustrated tendency towards something being related to another in a certain way over something that's statistically significant in numbers, so it can't, you know, so it has some sort of effect, but we can't say exactly what that effect may be. We can get kind of close in it, but we never have anything exactly proven, you know, 100%.
Yeah, or the numbers are hard to understand. Like the recent UN listing of meat and processed meat, cooked meat and processed meat as carcinogens, they moved them over to the is carcinogenic category. And people got mad at them for doing this. And people got mad at them for doing this because nobody messes with my bacon, man. You know, I want my bacon in a sandwich. But really, it was legitimate because there's enough evidence and to statistically to strongly suggest a link, and there's a mechanism. If you have both, then you can say something is carcinogenic. How carcinogenic is it? Not very.
Mm-hmm.
If you eat lower, I would say, than the average amount of meat, than the average American, then this is not even a tiny issue for you. If you're like my neighbor, and he's a great guy and everything, but all summer he has his cooker out, and he's processing meat every day, and mostly that's what he eats, I would worry about his health. Probably the cardiovascular disease from the high-fat diet is going to get you before the cancer does. But the point is, the increase in cancer risk for these dietary elements is real, but small.
Yeah.
And that's where that multidimensionality comes in, where people need to grasp that multidimensionality more. Yes, it's real that there's an increase, but no, it's small. The fact that it's small does not mean that it's not real.
And there's different terminology in what scientists use when they talk to each other than what we use in our everyday, you know, vernacular discussions of scientific issues. And that scale that you're referring to is one of those things where formaldehyde and meat and and glyphosate are all kind of in the same category, even though they don't have the same probabilities of whether or not your exposure to them would cause cancer.
Right.
Yeah, so.
And that's even true within scientists. Mm-hmm. And because I'm writing a lot on climate change these days, I talk to paleoclimatologists, I talk to climate modelers, I talk to people who are mainly physicists, people who are not physicists, and they actually have their own little tribes with specific dialects. And it does take some effort sometimes when people are talking to each other across, even within science, to make sure that we're all talking about the same thing, that we all mean the same thing, and we use the same terms.
So then what can the public do in order to know what sources to go to when they have questions about?
I often get asked the question, where can the public go to find something out? When I'm doing an interview, I often have, I'll write a blog post on my blog. By the way, you should go to my blog. Mm-hmm. I read a blog post there that will give the kind of information and I can point people to it. But really, I want to question the premise of the question.
Okay.
Because I think that if you want to really get engaged in the science as a citizen, as a science cheerleader citizen, if you want to get engaged in it, then the answer is not to go look something up. The answer is to learn about the sources themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You know, a little bit like what we do in academia when training graduate students, there's a period in people's training when they enter a new field where they have to get their handle on the literature. Okay. Usually you have graduate students write 3 or 4 or 5 papers that are literature reviews, and they have to read the literature and sensibly summarize it. And this is not a book report.
Right.
This is where you actually take peer-reviewed papers that have been written over a period of 10 years or 50 years. There's always a couple that go back 100 years, and a bunch of them, like 100, 200, that are within the last 18 months in your field or last 2 years, depending on the field. And you have to be able to know what all that literature is. You have to know what all the papers say. You have to be able to know, who do I call to find out about such and such a cutting-edge thing? What institution are they going to be at? That's what understanding literature is about. And you have to understand the nuances of arguments and how people may have changed their points of view over time. Now, I don't think the average science-interested person needs to do that mm-hmm. level. That's what a graduate student who's becoming an expert in the field has to do, okay? And the process of doing it gives you a deep and meaningful understanding of the topic you're talking about. I think what people need to do is find the dozen or so sources that are, to them, really useful and that seem to be honest and well done. And also, don't over-categorize the resources. You see this so often in the modern internet age where you're reading a certain news outlet and they do something really boneheaded. And
sure.
Then you never go back to that one again, because if they said that one thing wrong, they can never be right about anything else. They've lost their credibility. The loss of credibility is an internet meme, folks. It's not a real thing. You know, so-and-so offended me, therefore they have lost their credibility. You hear that all the time, and people don't even know what it means.
Well, okay. So like, you know, we talked about Discover and Animal Planet, and sometimes they'll produce shows that are totally...
They've totally lost their credibility.
Yeah,
of course.
But then they'll also have something like Blue Planet or something like that, where it is a decent show and strong on science, so it's more the independent producers rather than the channels, and I know that sometimes people get that confused.
Well, these projects are actually never made by a single corporation. They're always partnerships.
Mm-hmm.
A good example would be, for example, the Huffington Post. The Huffington Post is associated with anti-vaccination rhetoric and activism. I know lots of people who write great stuff for the Huffington Post, and they have some good, very good stuff. You can't rule out the Huffington Post because you are not because you're not an anti-vaxxer. You can be annoyed at the Huffington Post. You might even want to boycott them. That's fine if you want to do that. But
mm-hmm.
but if you actually want to read some good stuff about climate science, there's a few people who write some good stuff for them. Mm-hmm. The Guardian, by the way, if we're talking about sources, The Guardian is a great source. They're actually very intentionally trying to be the major news outlet that actually says, you know what, climate change is for real. We are the press. It's our responsibility to push climate change action.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's an existential threat. It's like the press coming out and saying, yes, we must defeat Hitler. And not saying, oh, we're going to take a balanced view and interview
right.
Hitler every time we interview Roosevelt. You know, they didn't do that. They went after Hitler, and we have to go after climate change. And The Guardian is saying that. At the same time, you will occasionally see some incredibly obnoxious thing in the Guardian. It's a big organization. Stuff mm-hmm. slips through. They have some stuff that I can't believe they published if they're actually saying that they're mm-hmm. getting, they're acting on climate change. But that's another source. But what you need to do is establish a relationship in a way to these sources that are out there. My blog is a good one. Everyone should read that every day, obviously. Everyone should listen to this podcast all the time. And on climate change, the Real Climate blog is written by actual climate scientists. It's a good, significant numbers, also on science blogs by Peter Glick. That's a California water. I want to be the teacher that says, no, I'm not going to give you the answer.
Mm-hmm.
Find out yourself. And it will be, you will then learn it better. Go find the sources that you can use on your own and report back.
We're gonna have a great guest on today's podcast. His name is Sean Lawrence Otto, and we'll come back to him right after this little musical interlude. Well, our guest for this episode is novelist and science policy expert Sean Lawrence Otto. Sean wrote an influential and important book, Fool Me Twice, Fighting the Assault on Science in America, in which he discussed the need to use good science to inform policymaking. We thought a conversation with Sean would help set the tone for the mission of the Econocast. In his book, Sean reminds the readers of Jefferson's quote, "Wherever the people are well-informed, they can be trusted with their own government." Fool Me Twice, Fighting the Assault on Science in America is available through the show notes on econocast.com.
Yeah, as Mike said, we did want to kind of set the tone for the show, and because we are going to be dealing with both science and science advocacy and science policy and that sort of thing, framing the show in terms of the importance of science and how science fits into day-to-day life and how it influences policy is what we kind of want to get at today. But I think we should probably do that by looking at some current events related to science and science policy. Did you happen to see any of the hearings that were held as of this recording yesterday in the Senate Commerce Committee on Climate Change?
I did, yes. That was the Committee on Space Science and the Economy, I believe, something like that.
Right, with Ted Cruz as the chair of that subcommittee. One of the things that happened during that hearing was Ed Markey noting that most of the legitimate climate scientists in the world were in Paris at the climate conference. The ones that were left, the science deniers, were the ones in that room being hosted by the Senate to talk about climate change. Now, that's not exactly accurate because actually only a small percentage of scientists were in Paris, and they had one legitimate scientist in the room. The implication is that we're coming to what some people are calling peak denial. What do you think of that? Are we at peak denial right now this year with the Paris conference, with the President of the United States talking about climate change as though it was real, that sort of thing? Or is that something we're going to see in the future?
You know, it's always difficult to say that this is the peak because in past times when people have said that, the denialists have trotted out a new trick. I think that we're probably going to see denial continue to increase throughout the course of this presidential election. I think Ted Cruz was clearly posturing, but I am hopeful for a number of reasons. One is that it's becoming increasingly clear to a broader and broader swath of the public just the amount of financial investment that oil and coal companies have been making in funding denial. And so journalists and the public are becoming more skeptical when they hear these alarming denial events that occur or claims that are made. But I also think that we may be reaching it because of what happened in Paris with the Heartland Institute, where they held one of their denial palooza conferences, and only 30 people showed up, and their speaker roster was 15 people. So I think that was, beyond being embarrassing for them, I think that it's showing that credibility and interest in this is waning, particularly in other countries, and that really it's only left in the United States Republican Party.
Cruz, in his summary statement at the hearings, and again today on an interview with NPR, went through a litany of denialist claims about global warming. For example, that the rate of sea level rise is higher in the first half of the 20th century than it has been in the last several decades. Do you think that he, just as an example of a prominent politician who is clearly denying science using old school denialism, do you think that he actually believes any of that?
Actually, I think that he does. There's a lot of psychology behind this where people tend to really embrace it. It's almost like radicalization. They come to really believe the ideas that they're espousing, and it becomes a sense of a cause. And that's what's dangerous about denialism, because you really can't, when you can't think clearly about facts and reason anymore when you become invested in a position and you engage in what's called motivated reasoning, where, like an attorney, you only look at and admit the evidence that supports your desired outcome. Ted Cruz, in his, you know, his wrap-up to that Senate hearing, identified 7 points, and we could go through and debunk those really quick if you want. They are classic examples of denialist points and how denialists take kind of obtuse, sciencey sounding claims that the general public is not going to have enough time or education to check out, and clothe their denialist arguments in what sounds like science.
Why don't you give us a couple examples of those claims?
He went through, you know, he identified 7 points that he, that were the big takeaways from his conference. And the first of those was that CO2 was good for plant life. Carbon dioxide was good for plant life. And, you know, while it's true that carbon dioxide is used by plants, the increased temperatures, the droughts, the floods, the coastal infiltrations that we're seeing are definitely not good for plant life on the whole. And generally, as since most of the landmass in the world is in the northern hemisphere, as the world warms and plant life moves further and further north, it actually winds up running out of geography. The next one was that the Earth is greening, he said. But in fact, according to the International Fund for Agricultural Development, which is part of the United Nations, about 25% of the Earth's land, which is about 3.6 billion hectares, is desert. And we lose another 12 million hectares annually, and the rate is increasing. So I don't know why he thinks that the Earth is greening. Then he said that for significant periods in history, there's been more carbon dioxide in the air. And this is kind of a classic sciencey thing that denialists like to trot out. And they particularly point to a period of time about 445, 450 million years ago when, by the way, which is about 200 million years even before there were dinosaurs. And they point to this period because CO2 levels were so high, but there was an ice age then. So they say, well, that's proof that carbon dioxide is not really causing any warming and is unrelated, because how could there be an ice age if we had much higher CO2 levels? But that was so long ago that the sun was actually much younger and much dimmer then, so there's a lot less energy to create global warming. So it's these little facts that are not mentioned that are often where the argument unravels. Another classic one, I mean, probably the most classic one in all of denialism right now, is that for the last 18 years, we haven't seen any warming. Satellite weather balloon data demonstrate no increase in warmth. But it's just patently false. And what that is basically, it's called going down the up escalator, essentially. I mean, that's what scientists call this, where you pick a very limited section in the statistical data of temperatures that we have charted out, and you start with 1998, which had a big El Nino, just like 2015 has a big El Nino. And we're feeling the effects of that El Nino right now because it's driving temperatures much higher. In 1998 was the last really big El Nino. So deniers always like to start with 1998 and say, well, there's been no warming since. We don't really know why, but it really shows that this is not the case, that the Earth isn't warming. But, you know, anytime you pick your endpoints, you can make the numbers say anything you want. Now what's happening, though, is that because of the big El Nino in 2015 is blowing that away because it's now hotter than even 1998, and the overall trend is up. So those are just a few of the examples that denialists use and that Ted Cruz used. And the problem with this kind of approach is that they can sound sciencey and they can throw out a fact in a sentence that requires, as you can tell from my answers here, mm-hmm. kind of long, paragraph-long, winding explanations that have to reference prior scientific data from other studies as well to understand why that's nonsense.
So Ted Cruz, you think, believes this stuff and has essentially created in his mind the idea that all these things are true. Isn't there somebody telling him that he's wrong? Shouldn't there be somebody telling him that he's actually embarrassingly wrong?
There should be, but I don't think that there is.
Have you been following the events in Paris over the last week and a half?
I have been a little bit, yeah.
Yeah. Are you familiar with the development that I thought was very interesting? You know, there's this 2.0 degrees Celsius sort of limit that people have agreed to target so that we use less and less fossil fuels and more alternative energy so that we don't hit 2 degrees Celsius total global warming.
Right.
That number is kind of arbitrary, but it's at least a target that everyone can get behind. And suddenly we're talking about a 1.5 degree.
Yeah, that was very interesting. Canada came in with that proposal a couple of days ago and blew everybody away. There were a lot of scientists and environmental groups that were surprised by that and very excited about it. But immediately there's talk about maybe making a trade-off on, say, expanding U.S. oil exports in order to broker a deal to get to 1.5 degrees.
I think we've learned to expect that the climate conferences start off with a lot of optimism, with a lot of with ideas of getting something done, of having some pretty strict regulations and maybe some big changes and so on. And then the discussion gets weaker.
Right.
Everything
exactly.
Peters out. Things get weaker and weaker. And then everything gets ignored later. And here we're seeing kind of the opposite. There seems to be more international strength behind this. There are people that are getting really serious here, and the change from 2.0 to 1.5 degrees Celsius as a cutoff for global warming proposed by Canada is really kind of astonishing.
It is astonishing, and it is, I think, indicative of a global change in attitudes. I think elected leaders are realizing that this is an issue that has very large political currency. There's a lot of organizing going on around it, especially in the Western democracies. Young people who tend to come out and vote in national elections are very, very concerned about this. And for the first time, we're seeing through science debate a receptiveness and an interest on the part of candidates, at least on the Democratic side, to talk about this more. So I think that there is a general global political change underway right now on this topic. We've seen the ouster of Tony Abbott in Australia, Prime Minister of Australia, who was a climate denier recently. And we've seen the massive turnover in Canadian politics, particularly around and driven by, no small measure, the environment and the climate issue, which is really substantial because a lot of Canada's economy is driven by resource extraction.
What do you think it has been making this change happen? Do you think it's because of weather events or because of the science finally settling in or because of effective activism? What is it that's causing this what seems to be a slow but measurable and real reversal in world thinking about climate change?
I think it's all of the above. There's been some really, really great work to help the media understand, for instance, so there, you know, beyond Mike Mann's kind of iconic hockey stick chart of global temperature and CO2, another iconic scientific study recently by John Cook and Stephen Lewandowski was the 97% consensus, which really boiled it down for journalists, and we saw a tremendous change in the confidence level of journalists to be able to disregard some of the nonsense arguments that climate deniers were coming up with when 97% of all climate scientists say that the world is warming, that humans are causing it. So that was a big shift. But in addition to that, we're seeing an increase in extreme weather events that is becoming increasingly hard for journalists and politicians to not face and to not connect with climate change, particularly since the general public is looking at this and saying, you know, we're getting a 100-year flood every 5 or 6 years now, and that's not normal. Or these hurricanes that are flooding New York City and New Jersey are, you know, not normal. What's going on in the sudden emergence of a hurricane off the west coast of Mexico earlier this year, and the highest ever recorded wind speeds, that's not normal. So these kinds of events are really starting to capture public attention, and that combined with some of the fundamental scientific work that has helped journalists cover the subject better, plus really great organizing by environmental groups, particularly driven by young people that are concerned about the topic, I think is helping propel science-driven conversation back into the forefront.
And I wonder, too, if something to do, you had mentioned the Canadian election, with the fact that the Canadian scientists were so public and outspoken about the fact that they weren't allowed to speak about their science to the press without getting cleared by a censor, might have wakened up people to the fact how important science is to policymaking, started helping with that shift a little bit, too.
It did, absolutely. Canada went through what was happening in the United States under the George Bush administration, but people kind of described it as Bush on steroids. And there was a lot of concern there. I did a show in Canada, actually based on my book, Fool Me Twice, that was a three-part, three-hour miniseries on science and politics and the history of it and why it's so important. And that was driven by Mary Link, who is a national CBC producer, and aired coast to coast. And it was inspired, I think, in large part by the demonstrations called the Death of Evidence that scientists put on in Ottawa, really protesting how they had to go through censors and media handlers that applied an ideological filter on what they could say to the press.
You mentioned the Consensus Project, and Mike's question, I think, relates to this in an interesting way. The people who want to deny climate change or the science deniers have, of course, tried to explain away the Consensus Project by saying that science is not about consensus. It's not about polling, or it's not about voting for what facts are for real. And, of course, what they're doing is they're distorting what the Consensus Project says. It doesn't say that scientists voted on whether climate change is real or any other aspect of the climate science, but rather the Consensus Project polls. There's more than one research project like this that either polls scientists or polls the literature to see what it says, to try to measure if there is an existing scientific consensus, and if so, what that is. But this brings up the whole question about how science works. You know, as a scientist, I've spent a fair amount of time in a room with a bunch of other scientists talking about science. And I can tell you that it is nothing like what we saw yesterday in the hearings or any of this conversation that's public. Everyone in the room is essentially engaged normally in an honest conversation in which you may very strongly disagree about things, but you're not trying to win an argument, and you're not trying to do something that has nothing to do with the science that's at the table. You're trying to solve some problem or figure something out or think something up.
Exactly.
You know, and one of the things that's happening now as a kind of email gate 3 or climate gate 3 sort of effect is the idea that when scientists converse about among themselves, that private conversation has to be a public record. And because we now know that a lot of this conversation happens in the form of email. Back when BitNet started, you had the occasional piece of information going back and forth in proto-email, and then emails became slightly more common, but not everyone used it. And now everyone uses email, and we have these long, extensive, and detailed conversations about science that way rather than in person. It saves a lot of energy and time and get things done faster. Lamar Smith is on a crusade to basically invade this private space of NASA scientists and prove somehow that they are making up this whole climate change thing. Have you been following the Lamar Smith? What do you think about that whole thing? Should science be so open that every conversation someone has, written or otherwise, should be just exposed all the time? Isn't that the right way to do it? Or is there some limit to how that should work?
You know, when Lamar Smith reminds me of Joseph McCarthy. I mean, this is very similar to the kind of ideologically driven witch hunt that Joseph McCarthy was on, trying to find communists and paint people that had any kind of left-leaning ideology as enemies of the state. And the problem with Lamar Smith's approach is that, yes, science is transparent, but the process of science also involves a lot of trial and error and fits and starts. And when you have somebody that has an ideologically driven agenda, looking at all the trial and error and the fits and starts before a conclusion is made that's made by evidence, it's like saying, all right, we've got a bunch of dogs on a fox hunt here, and they're sniffing out all these different potential foxholes and hiding places trying to find the fox. And look, they failed at that one. And, oh, they failed at that one. And look, they failed at that one. Look at how stupid that they are. You can take anything out of context, just like you take the we've seen no warming since 1998 by limiting the statistical record. And this is exactly the same kind of approach that Smith is employing. But the other part of this that's even more pernicious is it's a real abuse of the FOIA type of process, the idea that everything that every scientist, just because they have funding from a public university, everything that they say should be subject to scrutiny and reinterpretation by somebody with a political agenda. You can't work in that kind of environment and expect scientists to be particularly productive, because they're constantly having to look over their shoulder and worry about what Big Brother is going to be concluding about their conversations. Science has to be free in order to explore all the different permutations of a possible angle where evidence might lead, regardless of the political implications.
Yeah, I would add to that, in fact, some of these conversations would be no problem to release if the people, all of the people who would ever read them or use them, were basically involved in that honest conversation and not trying to, like you said, cherry pick stories about this fox being here versus and this fox not being over there.
Right. I mean, let me just give you one great example, which was the last time we were leading up to climate talks, right? With the whole quote-unquote climate gate, where unknown Russian-based, apparently, hackers hired by someone hacked into the CRU East Anglia email server and posted a bunch of private email conversations between climate scientists online. And you had the example of Hide the Decline that was a reference to something entirely different from what climate denialists, who took it out of context and fed it to the press, painted it out to be. So it's very reasonable to expect climate scientists to be very reticent about this whole Lamar Smith approach.
Yeah, and we still see the results of that email being used. People are still citing and reciting those original memes from that original hacking event. There's another factor that should be just mentioned, coming from paleoanthropology. This is probably more relevant there than other places, and that is that the public, completely public, open nature of science sounds like a good idea, but in fact, and in fact, your methods and your data ultimately and your results should be open. And in fact, in my view, we should avoid publishing in places where people have to have access to great libraries or pay a lot of money to get. We should have more open access publishing also, but there actually is a phase in doing science where things have to be kept secret. And this might sound automatically nefarious and bad, but it actually isn't. When you're a graduate student or a postdoc, and your career is going to depend upon getting a grant or two, which is going to relate to getting a couple of publications out, which will then relate to getting a couple more grants, and no, this is not piles of money. go meet a graduate student sometime. If you're one of the people who thinks that scientists are in it for the money, go meet a graduate student. Go and have dinner at their house. You will have to bring the food.
Right.
Okay. Because they're not going to have that much. Graduate students are, unless they come wealthy, they basically are poor. And if they are middle class, they get poor. Okay.
Yeah.
So this is the phase in your life where you're scraping along and you end up spending several months doing a pilot study. And then you spend a couple months working on a grant proposal. Then you don't get the grant. And then you spend a couple more months with a new pilot study. Then you get another grant proposal out. Finally, you get the grant. Then you go collect your data. And then you work up your data. And you then start spending your own resources because something went wrong when you were collecting the data. And now you're back out doing more work, but you don't have a grant for it anymore. And then finally, you get it into peer review. Your information in peer review has to be held confidentially.
Right.
You can't put something out on the internet in a blog post and then hand it over to a journal. They don't want it.
Right.
Okay. So at any point along the way, if someone had access to your data, they could just publish it and you're done.
Right. Exactly.
All that 2.5 years of your life you just spent is now completely wasted and now you have to start again. So, and then of course, when you get to a certain point, it then becomes, you know, then you want it all out there as much as possible.
Yeah.
But people don't realize this is like starting a business.
Right.
It's a little bit.
Very, very much. I mean, what you're talking about is primacy, right? And,
yeah.
And whoever has that in the intellectual record is the one that's credited with that discovery or that insight, that creation of that bit of knowledge. And science is, by its very nature, which is a good thing, highly, highly competitive. But if you can't stake out your turf, if you're required to expose it prematurely before you can do that, you lose, and careers are on the line here. Not only that, but the orderly process of science is on the line.
Ironically, the people who insist on this sort of open, quote unquote, open system, which really means being really nosy, are mm-hmm. advocating for a kind of a socialist science instead of a good old American democratic free market science.
Right, exactly.
Because you're going to have to pay, everyone's going to have to be on the dole and be paid the same amount of money for their research and their time, because the idea of being a bit competitive to get a job and to get grants and so on is going to be taken out of the picture completely.
Right. It'll be very much science by committee. You know, I kind of liken it to anything else in the creative process. And a lot of people don't think of science this way, but science is very similar to art. In fact, science grew out of the arts. And when you're creating something, there's a certain gestational point, just like there is in the life of an infant, that if you take that thing out of the womb and you expose it early before you've really thought through all the different aspects of it, the chances are you're going to lose the train of thought or the fine, delicate bit of understanding that you're trying to elucidate from nature. You're going to lose track of that, and your work is going to be for naught.
Yeah. Sean, you mentioned science debate.
Yes.
Can you give us an update? Tell us what science debate is and give us an update on what's happening with science debate.
Sure. In 2007, six of us, science writers and scientists, got together and formed an organization called ScienceDebate.org to get the candidates for president to debate the big science issues. And essentially, the idea is that science and technology really are becoming more and more complex, more and more inaccessible to people who don't have degrees in science. And at the same time, they're driving more and more of the conversation. In fact, there isn't an aspect of life anymore that science is not influencing. So we thought we need to find a way to do a better job of incorporating complex science information in the political discussion. So issues like climate change aren't left that have political currency, by the way, aren't left to kind of simmer until they become intractable political problems. Other science-driven issues that are similar but don't have as much money behind denialism but that have political currency are questions about whether vaccines cause autism. No, they don't. Whether GMO foods are unsafe to eat. No, they're not. About anything to do with control of the human reproductive cycle. Ideas about researching the public health aspects and drivers of gun violence. There's an endless source of topics that science can shed light on, And the idea of democracy, as we started off the podcast talking about, was that whenever or wherever the people are well-informed, as Thomas Jefferson wrote, they can be trusted with their own government. And the question is what happens now, 237 years later, when complex science and technology are driving the whole conversation? Are the people still well enough informed? So we thought, all right, if we can create a presidential science debate where the candidates get together and debate these topics, we can make sure that the populace is much better informed about them, about the real issues that are influencing their lives. So we did that in 2008, and we did not get a televised debate, but the website went viral, and within a few months, 38,000 scientists and engineers signed on, including lots of Nobel laureates, as well as CEOs of major tech companies and leading academics, the presidents of lots of universities, and major thought leaders. So even though we didn't get a televised debate, we got the candidates to respond online, and we made almost 1 billion media impressions, which was huge. No other topic, specialized topic, got anywhere near the coverage that we got for science in the 2008 election. And we did that again in 2012, between President Obama and his opponent then, Mitt Romney, who ironically actually, since Obama did so well the first time around, and you don't kind of tend to think of it this way these days, but Romney had much more substantive and scientific answers than President Obama did.
Yeah, I remember that, being a little bit disappointed on that. It's like he had passed it off to a lower level staff member who didn't want to say much.
Yeah, something happened there that was really surprising. But it was pleasantly surprising that the Romney campaign took it so seriously. This time around, we're working again towards a televised presidential science debate, and I'm increasingly hopeful that we might get something because of some conversations that I'm having with certain top-level officials that I can't talk about in much greater detail than that right now. But science is becoming increasingly topical. I think that politicians are realizing that the public is interested in it. We just did a recent national poll again and found that a whopping 87% of the public, similar numbers among Democrats and Republicans, think that the candidates for president ought to be debating these things. So the public gets it. It's just that the politicians and the news media, who hated science class in high school and ran away from it in college and wound up where they are in the humanities, are slow to catch on. But I think that they're getting there.
Can you confirm or deny that you're doing this with Fox News?
I have some very interesting things to say about that down the line, but I can't confirm or deny anything at this point.
Okay. All right. Not that I've heard anything. Okay. Another topic that I think Mike had mentioned to me earlier, I was hoping we would get to, is the recent revelations that ExxonMobil in the 1980s, late 70s, 1980s, was engaged in some pretty high level, sophisticated and intensive climate change research. They said then, prior to the work by Malcolm Hughes and Michael Mann, what we know now about climate change, which doesn't mean that they were smarter than everyone else, but rather we always knew this.
Right.
What we know now about climate change does go back, as one of the witnesses in the Senate hearings yesterday mentioned, global warming science is good, solid 19th century science.
There's an interesting chain of events that happened from the late 1970s through the mid-1980s. There was a, very similar to now, there was an oil glut in the market. Saudi Arabia saw the vast expansion in BP and Exxon oil rigs, particularly offshore oil rigs, which is a kind of a new thing back then. And they had a lot of competition from these non-Middle Eastern oil sources, and they didn't like that, and they decided that, as they recently did, that they would rather have lower prices and a bigger market share, so they removed their cap on their production, and the rest of OPEC didn't like it at first, but then they followed in line, and a couple months later, and there was a huge glut of oil on the world market, And the idea was that they were going to drive companies like Exxon with their more expensive oil operations out of business, or at least drive a lot of these oil wells out of business, make them too expensive to compete. So Exxon was going through a really hard time back then, and in order to cut costs, they wound up laying off a lot of people, including most of their climate science division. And then something fundamentally different happened in their corporate outlook when they were under this kind of pressure. Instead of thinking, you know, we've got to be good citizens about this, we are a major corporation and the public counts on us to think about this not just in terms of oil and our vested interests, but in terms of the broader energy portfolio. And they, you know, at the time they were doing research into alternative energy and how they could transition away from oil, because they knew that this was a problem. Their scientists were telling them. But this thing that changed then is that they decided, you know what, we're gonna start funding denial groups, and we're going to engage in a major public relations campaign to stave off regulation that could hurt our bottom line. And that's what they did. And their CEO, in the run-up to the Kyoto Protocol, gave a major speech in Beijing, and he identified at that point all the talking points that have become standard arguments of climate denial. They're all contained in that speech. It's really remarkable. And you can tell that some very careful public relations thought went into that speech, and those ideas have stuck since, and they were really the roadmap for the entire movement of climate denial that came.
So what do you think about the argument that they should be somehow punished by the system for doing that?
Well, absolutely. I think that democracy relies on evidence, and that they were clearly engaging in activity that borders on fraud, if it's not fraud. I'm not a lawyer, so, and I don't know that anyone can predict how this is going to play out through the legal system, but I know Eric Schneiderman's looking into it, the Attorney General of New York, through the Martin Act, which gives him broad discovery powers to explore whether any financial fraud was committed here. But there is certainly an argument to be made that, look, there's a fundamental risk to shareholders, and there's a fundamental risk to the public at large from climate change. And they knew about that risk. They knew the risk to their bottom line, and they knew the risk to the public, and they chose to obfuscate it and to deny it and to fund efforts to confuse the public about it, very similar to what the tobacco companies did around smoking and health. So should they be publicly sanctioned for that? I think if the evidence winds up supporting that outlook, that they did in fact engage in that kind of activity, then you bet they should.
One of the problems with this may be that some, at least some laws were changed or affected by court decisions in the wake of the tobacco lawsuits, which may make it a little bit harder for some.
What you're referring to, I think, is probably court decisions that have really weakened the RICO laws. I know that Sheldon Whitehouse, the senator, had called for investigation by the Department of Justice into Exxon for possible violations of RICO law, as had several leading climate scientists. But the problem is that, yes, the courts have substantially weakened RICO in the years since then, because many people tried to pile on with different kinds of RICO complaints after the tobacco cases, and courts started rejecting them, saying, no, we can't extend it that far. I've talked to one state attorney general who said that public safety and public fraud types of statutes at a state level may be more effective and a more effective way to go. And of course, the Martin Act, because the New York Stock Exchange is in New York City, the Martin Act is a very substantial state law that has broad implications because of its role in enforcement in the financial markets.
Sean, you have written a couple books, and I think Mike mentioned Fool Me Twice at the beginning of the show. Do you have any nonfiction book projects going now you want to talk about?
I do. In fact, thanks for asking. I've got a book coming out in April called The War on Science that takes the ideas that I started to explore in Fool Me Twice and expands them and updates them quite a bit. Exploring how this global, really, it is a really global war on science, has evolved, and the different angles of that war, the different fronts in that war, is really being driven by three fronts. You know, after World War II, we wound up commercializing a lot of chemicals that we had developed during the war. For instance, DDT, which we sprayed a lot of islands with in order to prevent soldiers from getting malaria. And other chemicals, use of nitrogen, which was used in munitions plants, and then afterwards in many of those plants were converted to fertilizer plants to use the same process to create fertilizer. And all of these aspects dramatically changed American life and American society, but they had unintended consequences as we quickly commercialized these chemicals. And we wound up with changes in the environment that led to Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, and the birth of the environmental movement and the field of environmental science. So there's a big split then between old oil and the petrochemical companies and environmental scientists on that issue. And then about a decade later, there was also a big split over our growing control of the human reproductive process. So we see kind of these science issues, which is really interesting about human reproduction and oil and chemicals, really determining the split in the parties today, with Democrats, scientists, and environmentalists on one side and oil companies and Republicans, and to a certain extent, engineers and geologists on the other side. And all of this is being driven by these advances in knowledge that we haven't figured out a good way of incorporating into our political process. So this has gone global in a lot of ways, in a lot of countries, nowhere as pronounced as it has in the United States, but it's simmering in many areas around the world as science is coming to influence more and more aspects of life. So the book talks about the sources of how anti-science came about through those splits and opposition to regulation. And it talks about opposition to advances in the life sciences by religious fundamentalists. And also how on the left-wing academics, particularly postmodernists, who believe that all truth is relative, that there's no such thing as objectivity, really created the fundamental arguments that are used by those on the right, ironically, to deny science these days.
Speaking of books, this is a holiday season and we often exchange gifts. In our family, we have a gift exchange where everyone, all the adults bring a gift and then they're wrapped up. And then, you know, you do this thing where you pick a gift and if you don't like it, you steal someone else's gift and so on and so forth. And after I got my first stab at getting the presents for that, for my family, I bought three. I was told it has to be a Minnesota connection to the presents. So I added a copy of your book to one of them. And I just want to mention that this is not a science book.
Great.
Although it's interesting because there's a lot of parallelism between what's in your story and what we're talking about. Because we're talking about ambiguities in law, in legal systems, and exploitation by corporations, and you know, that kind of thing a little bit. So do you want to just tell our listeners briefly what your novel's about? Because you're a guest and we want to, you know, promote your work generally.
Oh, well, that's great. Thank you.
Yeah, because we're not paying for you for this. We have to sell some books for you.
Oh, you're right.
No, I know it's a bad time to tell you, but.
Wow. Well, that's great. Thank you. No, that novel is near and dear to my heart. It's a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize. I'm very proud of that. It really tells us the story of a small town banker in northern Minnesota, who has a gambling addiction and has been, embezzling money to gamble at the local Indian casino. And the CEO of the bank chain discovers this and gives him a choice. this guy has noticed that there is a new building going up on the edge of the local Indian reservation that looks suspiciously like a bank. And if it is a bank, it's going to probably put the local bank out of business because they've become overextended by accepting a lot of casino deposits, but not making any loans on the reservation. They use legal ambiguities to get around the Community Reinvestment Act and avoid lending on the reservation because it's higher risk lending. So if the tribe is building their own bank and they pull their deposits, it's going to cause a real problem for this local bank. So the CEO tells this guy, the bank president, look, I'm going to call the FBI because you've embezzled $100,000. Or you can figure out if that's a bank that they're building there on the reservation. And if it is, you do whatever you have to do to stop it. So like the movie that I wrote, House of Sand and Fog, this story starts out with kind of a set of people coming from very different cultural backgrounds who don't really understand one another, and explores a lot of the grayness in our legal system as it escalates in kind of a thriller, Shakespearean, dramatic kind of way to a pretty intense conclusion.
It also explores kind of the nature of friendship, too, and an unintentional bonding that sometimes people do. And I thought that relationship between your main character and sorry, I don't remember the name of the main Indian that's involved in building the bank, how it seems like it might go further, and it possibly would if he wasn't at cross purposes with him. So that was great there.
Yeah, well, that's one thing that's actually really interesting in science, too, because, you know, we're living in an era now when scientists are working around the world, collaborating over the Internet, and cultural differences are things that scientists are really learning new skills in communicating around. I mean, they say science is the universal language, and it really is in a lot of ways. So I've always been interested in this idea of how people from very, very different cultural backgrounds communicate with each other and the assumptions that they bring to that relationship that both get in the way and that can help it.
Yeah, I love the treatment of the heroes and anti-heroes in the book. And as I mentioned, it's for those who are listening from Minnesota, it is a Minnesota-based story, and it's actually a Minnesota theme. Lots of places in this country do have important ongoing issues with relationships between Native American concerns and non-Native American concerns, but a lot of places don't. And so it's an interesting exploration of that.
It is. Yeah, one of the things that people don't really understand, I think, often when I've talked to people toured on this book, is that because of the way that the federal government has structured our laws, the Supreme Court has structured laws, the federal government holds title to most native land, and that provides some really interesting problems. Number one, a bank can't secure a mortgage with the underlying title to the property because the tribe can't give it the title. So banks sometimes use this as a means of not lending on reservation, and structurally then Native people who live on reservations are deprived of one of the main engines of economic growth in the middle class, which is your home mortgage. And then at the same time, tribes, because of this, can't levy property taxes because the federal government controls the title to the land. So they don't really have a very easy way of funding government operations. So they turn to things like casinos or to tourist traps or other business enterprises to try and fund government. And that causes all kinds of other problems. And corollary to that is the kind of the criminal justice side of it, because of this netherworld that we've created in our laws around them. Native tribes can't prosecute non-members for crimes that they commit on a reservation. So consequently, you see non-Native people committing crimes, especially crimes like rape, which occurs at a rate of 2.5 times the rate of any other ethnic group of women among Native women, and mostly by white men. So it's a real problem that we have to get our minds around. And again, as you said, Greg, it's created kind of by this legal limbo that we've set up.
I want to thank you, Sean. So there you have it then, the initial episode of Iconocast. We will be producing shows monthly, always about science with an eye towards what we as a society can and should do as we discover the secrets of nature and technology. We ask that you please go to iconocast.com and click on the link through to Amazon to order Sean's great book, Fool Me Twice. You'll help us grow and bring you more podcasts. Thank you very much for listening, and make sure to subscribe through iTunes or the podcatcher of choice.